So here again today, at the end of the gospel passage, I say what in another way of translating the word gospel to you, I say, there's some good news for you. And you say back to me, yeah, sounds good to us. Really? Does that sound good to you? I sensed a little flatness in your response to that gospel. And I'm with you. From the time I was old enough to pay any attention at all to the scriptures being read at Mass, I've had great trouble with this parable. I just could not understand why the servant who gave back all that his master had given to him to safeguard became the servant who gets such a terrible punishment. And there's this devastating line at the end of the story from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. Even when I was 10 or 12, this did not sound like the Jesus who came to proclaim good news to the poor. And listening to the way this gets preached sometimes, it certainly was preached all this way when I was a kid, it didn't help at all. It seemed that all of the people who preached this parable presumed that the voice of the master in this story is a stand-in for the voice of God. And that scared the heck out of me. The usual preaching on the gospel assumes that to be true. It might seem obvious. He's the master. He's the one in charge. Oh, that must be God. And the lesson the preachers took was, use what God gives you well. Use your talents, your possessions, your energy. Use them well in God's work. I'm not suggesting that's a bad idea. I'm all for it. It's an adequate message as a starting point. In fact, I get to travel around the country when I'm not here working with an institute that teaches Catholics how to recognize the gifts that God has given us and how to use them in the service of the world and how completely joyful that is to do right now. And how completely equipped we are by God to do that. It's a wonderful, important, life-changing, even world-changing message, but I don't think it's the message for adults in this parable. I just can't settle for that. When I started to delve into Scripture more as an adult, one of the first things I learned was that when you read a parable, if you take the simplest interpretation, you're probably wrong. At the very best, you're probably just looking at the very first, the very most elementary of the lessons contained in the story. Even as a child, I could not shake the idea that if the master in this story is the God figure, we are all in a heap of trouble. I'm a little conservative with money, especially if it's not my money. I'm risk-averse, as the financial folks would say. And I think I probably would have buried my boss's money, too. Anybody else out there? Show of hands. I might have taken it to the bank, but that would be the absolute most. It ain't mine. He's gonna want it back. He told me. The story uses the word talent to describe the wealth that is entrusted to these servants. You need to know something very important about that word. In the time of Jesus, in the time that this parable was recorded by the evangelist, that word talent referred only to money. It had nothing to do with describing our athletic ability or our singing voice or our ability to run fast or think fast. It had nothing to do with that. In fact, we use the word talent to describe those things now only because of this early elementary interpretation of the story. The word then referred first to a great weight of precious metal, and then later on, scholars tell us it referred to the single coin that had the greatest value in the Greek-speaking world. It was equivalent, some say, to about a year's wages, one talent. But whatever its real value, it referred only to money. If we take talent automatically to mean our abilities, our gifts, our strength, our thought processes, we're taking it out of context inaccurately. Now, sometime this week, I want to suggest to you that you go back and reread this parable. Please don't be like the person last night who asked me, well, where will I find it? You know where to find it, right? You got one at home. Find it. Reread that story and remember the fact that talent means only money. And when you're reading it, give up the simplistic idea that the voice of the master is the voice of God. That will change the story dramatically. It will become much deeper and, at least to my mind, a much more accurate description of what it is to be a disciple of Jesus in the world. Bear in mind also that scholars tell us, I wasn't there, I can't testify firsthand, but scholars tell us that the financial system of the day was corrupt and untrustworthy and tended to allow people to steal from one another. Thank God we've grown past that in our financial system. It was based on exploitation of the underclass. So putting the money in the bank was no safe thing either. That's the point. It makes sense if you take this second interpretation. It makes sense that the master, who is, as the story tells us, a demanding person who harvests where he doesn't plant, who gathers where he does not scatter, that means he steals other people's crops. It's what it says. He's a thief. It makes sense that this guy honors the servants who go out and participate in the economy just as ruthlessly as he does in order to make him wealthier. Notice, please, again, in the story itself, it doesn't say that the servants who went out and doubled their boss's money got to keep the money. What they got was harder jobs. You were responsible in small things. Come here, take this bigger job. Make me more money. That's why the master's happy, huh? And the one from whom the single talent is taken, it is given to the one who made 5 extra for his boss. Not so that he could keep it, but so that he could use that to make the boss more money. It's a different look at the story, huh? If we identify with this third servant as the one who refuses to risk someone else's wealth, who refuses to be ruthless in the economy, who is punished simply for doing exactly what he was asked to do in the first place, we see a whole different outcome to the story. The master is not the Christ who came to proclaim good news to the poor. The master is the villain. Whether you choose the old interpretation or this emerging interpretation, which is becoming predominant in scholarly circles, by the way, I think the central message is courage. All you Latin scholars out there will know what that means. Cor, or French, cour, heart. Take heart. Be strong of heart. The standard lesson is industriousness. Use what you're given, and that's okay as far as it goes. And if that is your lesson, look at the third servant. It's his fear, his timidity, that keeps him from doing what the master assumes he should have done. It's his fear that makes him bury the treasure. When I get to go around and work with others on finding their gifts and using them in God's work, the biggest fear that I hear played back from folks is fear. Fear of failure. What if I do this and it doesn't work? Fear of exposure to the world. Fear of, believe it or not, fear of appearing to be too Christian in this culture. These are real objections. So either way, we fear to do our work. Or, if we take the second interpretation, we have to understand that the world, the corrupt parts of the world that put the expectation on us to participate in a corrupt system. When we refuse to do that, the world will bring consequences down on us, and we will need courage to stay the course. So whichever of those two interpretations of the story you want, I'm here to promote the second, by the way. Take courage, because that's at the heart of it. However you choose to read this parable, as you come forth for communion, pray for courage. When you carry this communion out into the world, pray for courage that this week you will know and do the right thing, no matter what the consequences are.